You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Some 33 million cattle are killed and sold as meat in the United States each year. And Timothy Pacharat estimates that he personally helped kill at least 240,000 of them during the nearly 6 months he worked at a large Nebraska slaughterhouse. He'd taken the job in 2004 to learn firsthand what it means to participate in the massive routinized slaughter of animals for consumption by a society from which that work is almost entirely hidden. He describes his experiences in a new book called Every 12 Seconds, which is published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So where does that title come from, Every 12 Seconds?
The title refers to the rate at which cattle were processed and killed in the plant that I worked in. Approximately 300 head per hour translates into one every 12 seconds.
And you were working at one of the largest slaughterhouses in the country. So would I assume that the other ones also are working that fast?
Yes. Line speeds at the larger slaughterhouses tend to be upwards of 300 cattle per hour.
You haven't named the slaughterhouse in your book, and you've changed the names of the people you worked with. Why did you decide not to publish those names?
From the very beginning, this research was never meant to be an expose of a specific place or of specific people, but rather to collapse the distance between a meat-consuming public and a generalized description of how slaughterhouse operations work today.
Well, I was also wondering if you kept the slaughterhouse's name out of your book for legal reasons. Haven't some states passed laws that outlaw animal facility fraud, which involves taking a job in the food industry to write about that industry?
That's correct. As this book was going to press, in fact, the Iowa House of Representatives passed a bill which would criminalize any unauthorized access to slaughterhouses.
But not Nebraska?
Not Nebraska. And fortunately, the bill did not clear the Senate in Iowa, so it has not actually become law yet.
You're an assistant professor in the Department of Politics at the New School here in New York City, which would seem to be almost as far from the large-scale industrialized slaughter of animals as someone can get. How did you first get interested in the subject?
I was very interested throughout graduate school in how massive processes of violence become everyday and routinized in society. These processes include animal slaughtering, but also other processes like war, capital punishment and the imprisonment system. But slaughterhouse work seemed like a very useful way to get into this subject and to open up this topic to a broader readership.
And unlike war, you're not in danger of being killed yourself.
That's correct, although rates of injuries and illnesses in slaughterhouses exceed that of almost any other industry in the United States.
A number of books have been published recently about the industrialization of the meat industry. There was Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser, Eating Animals, Jonathan Safran Foer, Chicken, The Dangerous Transformation of America's Favorite Food by Steve Strifler. And, of course, there's the classic Upton Sinclair's The Jungle.
That's right.
How is your book different?
My book really seeks to explore the everyday lived experience of slaughterhouse work rather than just focusing on the most dramatic or the most gruesome aspects of slaughter. I really want to understand what it means for a typical slaughterhouse worker to be doing this work day in and day out. The other difference, if I may, is just that rather than focusing only on slaughterhouse work and making that information public, I'm interested in what that work can tell us about how distance and concealment operate more generally as mechanisms of power in society.
Are they happy to be called slaughterhouses?
They prefer the term harvesting plant, actually, which even further linguistically distances the work that's being done there. It's almost a plant metaphor, a crop metaphor for what's happening.
This involved your moving to Omaha, applying for entry-level jobs at the city's major slaughterhouses. Was that challenging for you to hide that you're better educated than most of your fellow applicants?
It was challenging in many different ways, one of which was an anxiety about whether I would be outed as a researcher in the plant.
And you had to park your Subaru in a lot across the way because it was just too good a car for somebody who was looking for a job like this?
That was very early anxiety in the research process. I later parked the Subaru with impunity in the plant lot.
You also describe yourself as brown-skinned.
Yes.
One of your parents was from Thailand?
That's correct.
So was that a help?
Yes. Very quickly upon going into the employment trailer, I was coded as what would be typical slaughterhouse laborer material. The fact that I actually did grow up in Thailand and am an immigrant to the United States made me fit in with the general population that's working in these plants.
And many people thought you were a Mexican.
Many people thought I was Mexican and were incredulous to learn that I wasn't.
After you'd been working in the slaughterhouse for several months, you nearly blew your cover by telling your bosses that you'd read Temple Grandin's book about more humane ways to slaughter animals. Do you think that they were more startled to hear that you were concerned about the treatment of the cattle or that you read books?
I think both were equally shocking to them. This came at a moment in my employment when I had been hanging livers in the cooler for over 2 months. And the opportunity came up for me to apply for a quality control position. So they brought me into the kill floor office and interviewed me along with the president and vice president of the company. And I remember the kill floor manager sort of leaning back in his chair and saying to me, "You know, Tim, if the whole world just sat around and talked like this, it would be a much better place." So it was the first acknowledgement in 2 months that he was actually dealing with another human being.
Well, later we'll get to the whole business of hanging livers. Perhaps the most startling insight that you had while you were working at the slaughterhouse was that the operation had been structured only, not only to keep the killing of these 25 cattle a day hidden from the general public, but also from the workers themselves.
Yes, this
How
is
actually structured.
This is actually what I think makes the book more interesting than just an expose to the general public. There is a very fine division of labor and space in the slaughterhouse. That means that the experience from any particular worker's point of view is quite limited. Out of a workforce of over 800 people, only 7 workers are in direct contact with the live animals, and only 4 are directly involved with the actual killing.
So most of them had no idea of the whole process?
People have a general idea, but it's the lived experience day in and day out that I was interested in. And in addition to the division of labor, there's a division on the kill floor itself between the clean side and the dirty side.
And you've identified 121 different jobs at the slaughterhouse. You were able to find out all those different jobs, even though you had only been limited to 3 or 4?
That's right. My promotion to quality control brought with it complete access to the kill floor and allowed me to cross different zones within the kill floor at will.
You include a description of each of them in an appendix. Are these the slaughterhouse's official job titles and descriptions? Because they include things like cattle driver, ear tag recorder, tail ripper, first legger, brisket saw operator. Some of them sound rather gruesome.
Yes, this is exactly how they're referred to in radio communication between plant managers.
My guest is Timothy Pacharat. His book, Every 12 Seconds, is published by Yale University Press. Now let's get to that first job that you had. It was as a liver hanger. Is that where most people start?
Not necessarily. I had no knife skills coming into the plant, and so basically only had my brute manual labor to offer. And fortunately, at the time, there was an opening in the cooler hanging livers, which is where they put me.
And how long did that job last?
I was there for a little over 2 months.
Then you lost – well, they lost a contract.
That's right. The livers were being exported to places like Russia and Korea, and the contract was up, and so they needed to move the liver hangers somewhere else in the plant or else terminate their employment.
But they still had to hang the livers, didn't they?
At that point, the livers were moved into pet food production directly rather than for human consumption, which is why they were being hanged in the cooler.
Your next job was working outdoors. Was that a better thing to be doing? You were a cattle driver.
Not at all.
Nebraska's cold in the wintertime.
Nebraska's very cold in the wintertime, but more importantly, this job put me into direct contact with the live cattle that were moving through the chutes.
And you were disturbed by how frequently your coworkers shocked the cattle with electric prods. You said that plastic paddles would have worked just as well. Do you think there was a dehumanizing or whatever word we want to use, an inuring to pain that went with this job?
Yes, although that wasn't the primary motivation for using the electric shocks rather than the plastic paddles. The chute workers are under enormous pressure from the kill floor managers to keep a steady stream of cattle moving through the chutes. And any delay at the front end of that stream means delay in production further down the line. So the workers were very much responding to that pressure and trying to keep the cattle moving through as quickly as possible.
And then you return to your job as a liver hanger.
Yes, just briefly before I was promoted to quality control.
And that must have been nice because you were no longer working in a cold environment.
Well, actually, the cooler was kept at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, so it was cold inside the plant in the cooler as well. But what was a relief about moving to that job was that it distanced me from having to confront the live cattle and the work of killing directly.
Well, during the few days that you'd worked outdoors in the cattle chute, you were also able to try out working as the knocker.
Yes.
This is probably the most, what word do I want to use, disturbing job?
It's probably the job where the confrontation between life and death is the starkest in the slaughterhouse. This is the worker who stands and for 9 or 10 hours every day at a rate of once every 12 seconds shoots a captive bolt steel gun into the foreheads of the cattle that are coming through. One thing that's very fascinating about this job is that the rest of the slaughterhouse workers actually create a kind of collective mythology around the role of the knocker, where out of the 121 jobs in the plant, this is seen as the only job that is actually morally troublesome because it's the job where the animal goes from being live to unconscious.
And some of your new friends in the slaughterhouse told you not to become a knocker because they said that the job would drive you crazy.
That's right. This is part of the mythology that gets built up around the role of the knocker and part of the transfer of responsibility around the work of killing to a specific individual within the larger chain. And I think this is basically a metaphor for how a lot of processes operate in our society, where we transform moral or experiential responsibility to a single individual for acts in which we're all complicit.
When you were in quality control, you said you got a sense of the total operation. But it would seem most impossible for an employee in that position not to understand the enormity and the brutality of the slaughter going on there. You've explained that even the quality control workers are so distracted by the rules and regulations that they had to follow that they can't focus on the big picture.
That's right. This is one of the insights that comes out of the research, which is that even under conditions of total transparency or total surveillance, a kind of partitioning of awareness is possible. As quality control worker, I was actually subject to a regime of technicalities where I was responding to temperatures, to pressures, to vacuum pressures, and so on, in such a way that even though I had full visible access to the slaughterhouse, my attention was driven by what I needed to be doing in relation to the USDA.
But I'd also imagine that quality control people don't want to know.
That's correct. So, for example, one of our responsibilities, there were two quality control workers. One of our responsibilities in that job was to do what's called an animal handling audit, where we were literally meant to go out to the chutes with a form and record how many cattle bellowed, how many slipped and fell, and so on. My coworker, my fellow quality control worker, absolutely refused to do this job because it would put her in contact with the live cattle. She just filled out the paperwork in the office.
Could these operations have been done in a more humane way?
What's driving these operations is the need for a high line speed. And as long as that line speed needs to be high, it's impossible to do it more humanely.
So Temple Grandin's cow chute, which at least makes the cow feel a little better, that would be an added expense and it would slow things down.
Interestingly, the slaughterhouse I worked in employed Temple Grandin's design for the slaughterhouse. But that design only works if the cattle are allowed or permitted to move up the chutes at their own speed. But again, because of the pressure on the chute workers, there was a constant driving of cattle in ways that were antithetical to what the design was meant to accomplish.
What were the circumstances for your having to leave the slaughterhouse rather abruptly?
Yes, originally the plan was to stay in the slaughterhouse for a year. But after I was promoted to quality control, I became involved in a whole series of ethically problematic work where, although officially our job was to monitor for food safety, unofficially we were running interference against the USDA and trying to keep them from discovering problems in the plant.
A USDA inspector asked you if you would act as an informant?
That's right. I was approached the morning before I left the job and asked if I would essentially testify on behalf of the USDA about food safety problems in the plant.
But he was surprised to learn that you were not there under the circumstances that everybody thought, but rather doing research
Yes.
So did he blow your cover?
No, he didn't blow my cover. We met after work, and when I told him what my purpose for being in the slaughterhouse was, he agreed that the larger purposes of writing the book were equally important.
It's been 5 or 6 years since you left the slaughterhouse.
Yes.
Why is the book coming out now?
It takes time to produce a book, and there were some theoretical and analytical work that I wanted to do around the fieldwork material that I had collected.
Did working at the slaughterhouse change the way you feel about eating meat?
This is very importantly not a book that's meant to be a manifesto either for or against eating meat. I'm very interested in asking the question, what happens to our deliberations around things like eating meat or other kinds of social practices when we begin to collapse the distances that separate us from them and allow us to participate in them almost unreflectively?
So you would, if we had a more humane way of dealing with the cattle, you'd feel better about the whole thing?
Not necessarily. I think that there is something deeply problematic about taking the life of another sentient being. But I do think that what's important is less a blanket condemnation or advocation of meat eating than the level of thoughtfulness or lack thereof that we have because of the ways that these processes are distanced from us and hidden in plain sight.
Timothy Paturat is assistant professor in the Department of Politics at the New School University. His book, Every 12 Seconds, Industrialized Slaughter and the Politics of Sight, is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.